You're in the middle of nowhere, with the day fading to a pale band on the horizon. From the descending dark, a bus pulls up, brightly lit inside, but with no name, no destination. The door shuttles open before you. There is no driver. Do you climb aboard? Of course you do. That's why you're here. Welcome to the Gray Line. Tonight's journey will take us to two very different locations for two equally unsettling tales. Our first stop is Hollywood, California, fabled home of the loftiest of dreams and the hardest of luck. Speaking of which, see that man seated behind the driver? That's the Joe Barris, one of Tinseltown's most bankable movie stars of the mid-90s. Poor Joe's star has faded a bit since then, which explains why he's taking public transportation. Fortunately for him, though, modern biotechnology might just grant him one more chance at the limelight. If, that is, he's willing to share it. With 11 invisible, haunting personalities, an audience of disembodied minds watching from across the uncanny valley of the Gray Line. I met Fyodor Trask, the tech billionaire, at a party up in the hills. I was loath to admit it, but he was more famous than me at that point, a fact that I pretended neither of us knew.
It's called segregated cerebral imprinting, or SCI,
he explained, speaking over the noise of the band, the splash of the pool, and the raised voices of a few drunk producer types. The producers had barely acknowledged my presence, mere half-salutes with their tumblers, even though I'd been in blockbusters for both of them a few years back. I nodded and tried to look bored. The trades say that it'll be like a reality show in the brain?
It's a crass description that my PR people came up with.
Trask looked sour.
But accurate enough. Eventually, SCI will be used for transplanting personalities into donor brains, granting effective immortality. We're a few years from total integrative override, though. For now, the new personalities will just be along for the trip, experiencing what the host brain experiences, feeling what they feel, but only one way. There will be virtually no impact on the host's actions or thoughts. The imprinted personalities will just be riders. So yeah, sort of like a reality show. People want to know what it's like to be a famous movie star, to live the life, you know? They're willing to pay for it. Early adopter types, especially the terminal rich. Old money, old bodies with no other options.
The article in Variety said it was a paying gig, is that right? I asked this as if it didn't matter. I sipped my whiskey and tonic.
For an A-lister, yes.
Trask answered, eyeing me sideways. I'm still an A-lister, I laughed, as if it was ridiculous to have to defend myself. I make headlines all the time. Trask's smile turned wry.
Your last headline was when that crazy fan broke into your house, convinced she was your wife or something. That was, what, 18 months ago?
She was nuts, I nodded vigorously. The news called her Fatale Franny, you know, from my movie Femme Fatale back in 09. Good thing I wasn't home. They found knives in her purse when they carted her away. History of mental problems and violence, they said. She wanted to seal our vows with blood. Of course, that part wasn't in the paper. I laughed and spread my hands in a what-are-you-gonna-do gesture.
Yeah,
Trask said, still eyeing me narrowly.
I'll talk to my people, Mr. Barris. I admit we haven't gotten the applicants we'd hoped for. If indeed you're interested...
I was. I pretended otherwise, but damn it, I was, because Trask was right, the bastard. It had been a while since I'd been in the spotlight. And the spotlight's a drug. The longer you go without it, the greater you need your fix. A month later, I met Trask's people at his company headquarters in San Francisco. The place was huge. Brand new, still smelling like paint and shiny metal and tech-minted money.
walls of curved windows surrounded levels of open workspace. Bustling people in jeans and lab coats carried iPads and Starbucks lattes. "Doesn't feel very medical in here," I said to the woman as she led me to a glassed-in room in the middle of the space. She looked about a third my age, Asian, with tortoise-shell glasses and a black ponytail.
"We aim for that," she replied. "We want everyone to feel at home, both the technicians and the guests."
"Is that what I am? A guest?" She led me into the glass room. It was a sort of examination room, with a concrete floor and an open ceiling showing the matte black girders and the steel roof high overhead. She tapped a panel on the wall and the glass blanked opaque. I sat down on the examining table and started to unbutton my shirt.
"That won't be necessary."
The girl smiled and tapped her head.
"Everything we'll be looking at is right in there."
I nodded and took a deep breath. An hour later, I was back in my car, feeling like I was just starting my career again, driving home too early from a random audition, desperate for a part I had little hope of landing. "Thank you for your time, Mr. Barris. We'll be in touch. The receptionist will validate your parking." But this time, I did get the part. The Trask Tech doctor called me the next day. I was scheduled for the procedure the following Monday. "You guys move fast," I said, feeling a little lightheaded, groping for a kitchen chair, dropping into it.
"That's how we roll,"
the doc said, her voice smiling.
"Are you having second thoughts, Mr. Barris?"
No, I answered automatically. "It's just, are we sure this is, you know, safe? Really?"
"You're not our first test patient,"
the doc said.
"You're just our first public trial. Like last year, the launch for Trask Space. You probably watched that on TV, right? But it wasn't our first launch. Trask never goes public with something until we know it works."
I nodded, feeling a little punch drunk. "So, like, will it hurt? Will I feel them in there, in my brain? Who are they even?"
"No, Mr. Barris, you won't feel a thing. It's a minimally invasive procedure. The imprinting is segregated to just one section of the brain, the corpus callosum, simply because there's a lot of extra room for rent in there. And we feel it's best you don't know who the imprinted personalities are. You don't know them, and you won't sense their presence. They're just fans who are willing to pay a lot of money to experience the life of a movie star. Fast cars, a lavish lifestyle, beautiful women. Their generosity and courage will pave the way for more practical uses later on."
"I think they might find the life of this particular movie star a bit disappointing." I sighed and laughed weakly. "Will they, like, be able to control me? I keep thinking about a line from one of my movies, the remake of East of Eden. Something about monsters being born of human parents. They won't be monsters, will they?" I laughed again, as if it was a joke.
No monsters, Mr. Barris."
The doc smiled through the phone.
"We screen all the monsters out, I promise."
"Because you all read your George Steinbeck," I said, still laughing.
"John Steinbeck?"
the doc said.
"Yes, it was required reading in medical school."
"So they won't affect me, you're certain. Will they, like, be able to read my thoughts?" It was occurring to me that there were a few things I wouldn't want even the anonymous audience in my head to know.
"They won't share your memory or know what you're thinking,"
the doc assured me.
"We call it segregated imprinting, so they'll be partitioned from your thoughts. They're observers, and they share the feedback of your experiences. But no, they're virtually incapable of influencing your actions."
"Virtually?" The doc sighed.
"The eventual goal of SCI is to transplant consciousness into donor brains in grand control. So technically, the capability is there. But we'll be imprinting a total of 11 riders into your cortex. It would require them all to agree to impact your motor control. These are 11 extremely unique and different minds, Mr. Barris. And needless to say, all of them are for people who are quite accustomed to doing whatever they wish. Teamwork is not their strong suit."
I was mollified. I agreed to the procedure. As a Hollywood veteran, the idea of having a permanent audience in my brain didn't strike me as uncomfortable. It was an outpatient procedure. They went in through the back of my neck, right there in the glass room in Trask Tech's bio lab. They tested me with electrodes afterwards and said that all 11 imprints were intact and active. The brain scan looked like a scribble of colored lines, all overlapping, like a waveform of 11 different songs playing over top each other. I made the next month's cover of Wired. And I started getting scripts again.
And in movie news, 90s star Joe Barris.
The news coverage had brought me back into the limelight. I took on a starring role in a horror movie called Carnival and began filming in October. It was an age stretch, the trades said, but the studio got me a trainer and soon enough I was back in prime condition. One wag at Variety quipped that the credits for Carnival would read, Joe Barris and his 11 Nobodies. I wondered if the Nobodies were indeed disappointed with my celebrity lifestyle. It was definitely fewer fast cars and loose women, way more long days on set and hours in the gym. I tried not to think about them watching from the dark balcony of my brain. I did change my habits a little. I drank a little less. Bathroom visits were weird. Nothing was private anymore, technically. The Nobodies were always watching. I only noticed things getting weird after a few weeks. I'd find myself reaching for the roast beef instead of the tuna salad at the craft services table. Or watching Jeopardy in my trailer instead of ESPN Classic. I wondered about it, assumed that my tastes were changing a little, no biggie. But it got more pronounced. I was headed out to dinner one night. I hopped into the studio courtesy shuttle and told them to take me to Club Trapeque instead of the commissary. The shuttle took off and I sat back and blinked to myself, frowning. I didn't want to go to Club Trapeque. That was a paparazzi haunt, a hangout for young actors trying to get seen pretending not to want to be seen. Scratch that, I called to the driver. Let's hit the commissary instead. The driver shrugged and hung a left. It got worse. On set at the carnival, I found myself flirting with Hilda, the 20-year-old girl playing axe victim number 3. She looked at me with undisguised contempt, and I realized what had been coming out of my mouth. I apologized, retreated to my trailer in the shadow of the Ferris wheel, closed the door, and turned on Jeopardy. I plopped down to watch, realized what I was doing, and scrambled for the remote, clicking the damn thing over to ESPN. Golf was on. I turned the TV back off. That Sunday morning, I went to see the jeans and lab coats at Trask Tech. They pasted on the electrodes and read the scan. They were silent for too long, then retreated outside the glass room and talked to each other animatedly. I was getting impatient.
This is unexpected,
the head doctor said.
I'm going to have to study it a little more. I'm sure things are fine and there's no danger. But just for now, try not to fight the influences too much. It might make things worse.
Try not to fight... You mean the Nobodies? The doc grimaced at that. It didn't really matter. The Nobodies were exerting more and more influence all the time, it seemed. I couldn't resist because when it happened, I was hardly aware of it. My body would simply start doing things. My mouth would start talking, and I'd just assume that I had caused it to happen. It was only in the following moments that I'd look back with dismay, like a driver who realizes he's just missed his exit and doesn't know where he's headed next. I didn't know how the Nobodies were doing it, exerting such unanimous and increasing control over my body. But it was clear to me what they wanted. They wanted fast times, lavish parties, flash bulbs popping at me in the street, women throwing themselves before me. They wanted all the cartoon trappings of celebrity and fame. I began feeling less and less like an operator of my body and more an occupant in it. The only moments I felt fully in control were the boring drudgery times. The hours in the gym and the makeup chair, and the endless shoots and reshoots on set. It was Fyodor Trask himself that called with the news. I was just finishing a night of filming, walking back through the carnival toward the makeup tent.
It would seem, Mr. Barris, that individual personalities have no mass,
Trask said, getting right to the point. What's that supposed to mean? I hissed into the phone. feeling ragged, knowing that my minutes of control were short.
It means that we segregated a portion of your cortex large enough for the occupation of 11 unique personalities. But apparently personalities don't work that way. They don't take up space. They're less like water drops filling a syringe, more like beams of light falling onto the same section of floor. They don't stack up and fill more space. They just get brighter, blend into one, taking up the exact same amount of room. It's amazing, really.
Look, Trask, I said, feeling my control leeching away. There was a limo waiting outside the makeup tent, long and black. The nobodies had seen it. Their curiosity was piqued.
You said the nobodies couldn't affect me because they couldn't agree with each other. They were too different.
They're not different anymore,
Trask said, his voice tiny but excited in the phone.
They blended into one, like 11 different colors forming one brilliant spot of light. Their will can be unanimous now because they've become one mind. It's right there in the brain scan. One waveform from 11, all compressed into a unified singularity.
I opened my mouth to tell Trask that they should have foreseen this, to demand that he do something about it and quick. But no words came out. My eyes had drifted to the door of the limo as it opened, revealing one long bare leg and a short black hem. A woman stepped out, smiling, meeting my gaze. Her lips were the color of plum, her hair falling in brown waves, her sincere eyes magnified behind her glasses. The nobodies didn't know who she was, but they were instantly enthralled by her, by the avid adoration on her face. The phone lowered in my hand.
Mr. Barris,
the woman called.
I thought I'd offer you a ride. A little token from your number one fan?
Is that so? My mouth said and smiled. My feet angled toward the limo, carried me past the makeup tent into the colored lights of the merry-go-round. Its rows of bulbs reflected cheerily in the lines of the limo.
Oh yes, Mr. Barris, I am definitely your number one fan.
The woman enthused.
I feel I've known you my whole life.
A heavy purse swung against her hip, clanking faintly. She stepped aside and held the door. My body climbed inside, sank into the leather back seat amidst the smell of shampooed carpet and expensive cigars. The door closed. The woman got into the driver's seat, slammed her door, then pushed a button. The locks clacked all around the car. She turned and smiled broadly at me through the glass partition. The nobodies smiled back at her with my lips. This is just the sort of thing they'd been looking for, after all. The things that come with celebrity and fame.
I just know we're going to be super close, Mr. Barris.
The woman breathed eagerly, shifting the car into reverse, still looking back at me.
Can I call you Joe? I'm Francine, but my friends... You are my friend, right? My friends, they call me Franny.
A grim final act for poor Mr. Barris, it would seem. And yet, as we depart our brief layover in Hollywood, you may choose to hold out some slim hope that we may find some cheer at our next destination, the subtropical shores of Queensland, Australia, where the sunny beaches belie 1,000 dark, untold stories. One of them, in fact, is seated just behind you. Don't worry, Willie's harmless, despite his wrinkled face and squinting scowl. He's a charter boat captain, with a sour demeanor, a rather bleak opinion of the people, and a midnight appointment to keep, 7 miles out, and 1,000 feet over the murky, unplumbed depths of the Grey Line.
Willie had a sense of humor. He could prove it.
Not by the name painted on the back of his charter boat. It was called the Tropic Tern, after the seabirds that the tourists went all on about. That had been the name of the boat when Willie bought it, and he'd seen no reason to change it, much less to repaint the fading brushstroke letters in the 20 years since. No. Willie's humour was shown on the side of the deckhouse. Hung next to the door was a joke life preserver ring bearing the words, "No one can save you now." Willie figured it was funny enough to satisfy his lifetime quotient of humour. He pointed it out every time a new charter boarded the boat.
"Just in case you were wondering,"
he'd say, and point, and everyone would laugh. The older Sheilas in their sun hats, the younger blokes with their tattoos and blonde tips, the businessmen in striped polo shirts and khaki shorts. It was the same every day, every year. The Tropic Tern would troll a few miles out into the Coral Sea for whale watching, fishing for ocean perch and marlin, or just some good old drinking and grabassery, all to the tune and stench of the old diesel. Willie ran the boat with nary a second thought. Sometimes there would be storms and the passengers would get sick, but not Willie. He'd been in the Navy. The ocean mist and battering wind were old friends. He figured one day he'd get into trouble for drinking and boating. People didn't know that it was illegal, so they'd offer him a beer or two while out on the waves. Willie accepted stoically, even though he had his own flask tucked into his jacket and a few bottles stowed away in the hold. Willie was never opposed to a snootful. It passed the time and made even the most annoying passengers bearable. Amazingly enough, he'd been mostly sober when the Tropic Tern had gone down. It hadn't been his fault. The sky had been clear as a nun's conscience, the August sun beating down like a dead blow hammer, steaming the mist off the deck and reddening the balding heads of the overweight businessmen. They'd come to Queensland for some sort of conference. Insurance, they'd said. They'd said more, but Willie had stopped listening. The women that were with them, likely not their wives, had drunk wine and laughed too loudly and fanned themselves with their hats. They were all dead now. They'd screamed from the waves until the screams gargled, and Willie hadn't been able to tell the women's screams from the men's. He'd wondered if he'd see any of them bobbing around in the dark. He was a little surprised that he hadn't so far. Dead bodies floated. That was another thing that he'd learned in the Navy. Of course, the sharks might have gotten to them. Maybe that's why the buggers had left him alone so far. He kicked his legs a little. The water was warm. The waves bobbed him up and down in a ponderous, monotonous rhythm. At the top of each wave, he could just see the distant lights of Port Douglas, 6 or 7 miles away. At the bottom, all he could see was glinting, bottle-black water all around. It had all happened so fast and so stupid. One of the blokes had gotten drunk and climbed up onto the deckhouse roof. Willie heard the footsteps bumping overhead, then the yelling. The drongo was barefoot, and the sun had heated the steel roof to a griddle. The bloke hollered, scrambled off and bellowed for water for his steaming feet. He was probably kidding, although it was a stupid joke. Even stupider was when one of the other yobbos grabbed a nearby jerry can and doused his mate. Only it hadn't been water. It had been diesel fuel, of course, and the bloke was smoking a cigar. Willie knew that diesel isn't all that flammable, actually. Not like in the movies, where one drop match would blow everything to the moon. So he'd come out to calm everyone down. They were all screaming and running around. The jerry can was still lying on its side on the deck, glugging pinkish fuel all over the damn place. It stank and made the air shimmer. The barefoot bloke spat out his cigar like a kid spitting out broccoli. It landed on the puddle and the ash scattered. Fire, Willie knew, is about the perfect mix of fuel, oxygen and ignition. Yet one more thing he'd learned in the Navy. Nobody burned to death except the Tropic Tern. It took 20 minutes, maybe less,
and the fuel tank had blown. The flaming hull rolled over like a drunk in a gutter, half dousing itself, fully dumping everyone into the darkening waves. It went down a few minutes after that, leaving nothing but a spreading slick of diesel and a scar of gulping bubbles. The charter people screamed and thrashed and clung to each other and went down in ones and twos. Willie didn't see any of it happen. He'd floated away, musing to himself that fate, like him, also has a sense of humour. He floated now in the pitch dark. Clouds had snuck in like looters in a blackout. There was no moon, no stars. Nothing but the slosh and slap of the waves and the warm wind drying Willie's hair. He looked down at the old life preserver ring. In the dark, he could only just make out the words, "Save you now."
"Drat and damnation," Willie muttered to himself, but he didn't really mean it.
The flask was still in his inside pocket, half full. He tugged it out, spun off the cap and tossed it away. Sweet, expertly. The triangular fin surfaced silently, 30 feet away, black and oily in the darkness. He traced the curve of a cresting wave, then dipped again, furtive as a periscope. Willie nodded and watched. A few moments later, another fin sliced a wave on his right, closer now. He raised his flask and toasted it.
Alas, another bleak end, it would seem. But not for you, faithful traveler, not this time. Please collect your baggage, should you have any, and thank you for traveling with us. And as always, remember, not every journey ends so conveniently. The next time you board with us, you may find yourself lost forever. Just one more story told on the forgotten highways of the Grey Line. The Grey Line is produced by me, G. Norman Lippert. The Nobodies featured the voice talent of Juss Sargent as Fyodor Trask, Kat Amick as The Doctor, and Joy Craig as Fatale Franny. Drat and Damnation was narrated by Juss Sargent. If you enjoy our eerie tales from the Forgotten Highways, be sure to tell every single one of your friends, and a few choice enemies. Also, leave a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can check out my books in print, ebook, and audio format. For more information, check out gnormanlippert.com.